This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Tom, Rich and Brandy back refreshed after a very quiet weekend. Sunday, January the 17th. We've been talking vaccines this morning because that is still the big story. Having a look at whether we could see a vaccine-driven bounce back economically in the second half of this year. That's with Daniel Richards, senior economist from Emirates NBD, who's also been speaking to us about the US president-elect Joe Biden's plan for economic stimulus and the latest UK GDP numbers. Is the UK headed for a double dip recession? And if so, what does that mean for us? You'll be able to go and visit Expo 2020 Dubai next week, or at least one pavilion. We speak to one of their key executives about that and what the pandemic has meant for Expo's forecasts for numbers. Finally, we've been talking aviation. Big news this weekend, Emirates suspending three flights into cities into Australia. We've been looking at the potential whys of that decision with the aviation expert, Nick Humphreys.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Bradley Scott got the vaccine this weekend.
Saw. All over the gram.
That's it. I've done it for the people, Tom.
Yeah. Take one for the team. Quite right, too. That's what it's all about, you know. Good on you.
No,
all good? You're still okay? Feeling fine?
I appear to be still okay. No actual sort of symptominess whatsoever. I had been told that it's not 100% unusual to feel a little bit sniffy or whatever. That's your body sort of making the antibodies and fighting the dead bugs. But nope, didn't feel a thing.
Well, and that's why, because I had it back in August, and I just assumed that I'd had a placebo as part of the trial because I felt nothing. I mean, getting the injection, you barely feel it. And it's like a scratch. It's a very, very small needle. So you barely feel the injection. And then I just didn't have any sniffles, no side effects at all. So I thought, well, clearly I've just been given an injection of water or saline or something. And it was 2 months later, I went and got the antibody test. And lo and behold, yeah, I was bursting with them. So I had, presumably, the jab. But yeah, the lack of any kind of side effects surprised me because I expected modest or mild side effects. But that seems to be the exception rather than the rule for people who've had it.
The more and more research that we're getting into the roots of the virus, I think this is a conversation that's been had, I'm sure, by many people, is that the old, you know what, I think I had it, but I think I had it probably back last year at some point because I was laid very, very low, etc. And the fact that we're now getting reports of cases from March last year in Europe, March, April, May, that sort of time was when they saw the first ones, cases in the water in Italy over in sort of May last year. There are a lot of people sort of tracking back and going, oh, maybe that's why I felt so dreadful June last year, July last year, whatever. So it's going to be a very difficult one to track, I presume, moving forward. And then, of course, with the new mutations that are causing all the panic at present, it is something that we're going to be with for quite some time.
But certainly the UAE, still second in the world in terms of numbers of vaccinations per 100 people. Shruti just mentioned the number there. It was 18 point something, wasn't it, per 100 people, second only to Israel, is just astonishing. 139,000 people, I think it was, yesterday got the jab. I mean, we've done. You can do the maths on the back of an envelope. The country's going to be done by Valentine's Day.
Yeah, look, I'm seeing more and more people posing with their little vaccine band-aid on social media. I know of a lot of people who are booked in to go down this week as well, because there are a number of different ways you can do it. I didn't actually book. I went to a walk-in centre.
So you went down to Al Ittihad Centre.
I did. Al Ittihad Centre down by the new canal. Timed it. I had been told that if you want to go, what you need to do is go in the afternoon on a weekday. Anything from sort of 1:30, 2 o'clock onwards to the end of the working day is your friend. And that was certainly the case. It wasn't my first stab at doing this, pun absolutely intended, because I had popped down on the Wednesday night after dinner. I'd been out for dinner and decided after dinner that I would go straight from table to tent.
But it was chock-a-block, and so you left, didn't you? You turned around and left.
And that was my fault because I kept putting off the delay from dinner. I'll leave in 15 minutes. I'll leave in 15 minutes. I'll leave in 15 minutes. Some things don't change because I was having a nice time. So I got there just an hour, really, before the entire thing closed. And we did that thing of, you know, we stayed in the queue for sort of about half an hour and thought, oh, it's going to close at 10. By the time I get through, breakfast presenter really need to get a decent sleep, and abandoned the mission. But then went back the next afternoon.
And got it done.
And walked in. Here, top tips for you. Number one, take a pen, because there are forms to fill out, and you might as well have your own pen. You smile, but take a pen.
No, I smile because I just don't think it's advisable for all of us after a Thursday night dinner to be heading out for a vaccine. Some of us might have a rather different experience. Brandy, to her credit, is a very sensible person.
Extremely sensible. Number two, take a woman.
Sure, no problem at all. Okay. Happy with that.
Because it will get you in the family queue, and the family queue is far, far, far shorter. Number three, as I said, go midweek afternoon.
If you're lucky enough to be able to take time off work. But then you went with someone who has got a normal day job, not the crazy hours that we work, and you had the conversation without giving too much away. Which employer wouldn't want you to go and get the vaccine at the moment?
Yeah, if you literally say, I'm going to take 2 hours off this afternoon, I mean, 45 minutes it took me from start to finish, but I'm going to take an hour or so off this afternoon, I'm going to go and get the jab. I think most employers will be like, yeah, that's great, off you go then.
Yeah,
take lunch.
Just not. I mean, if you work in air traffic control or something, then you can't just abandon your post, and I get that, but for many jobs, you can do. The Wall Street Journal's got a really good piece on this this morning, that their correspondents based out here in Dubai, and they quote a gentleman by the name of Ralph, who's a construction manager who lives out here in the UAE, who said that he took the vaccine. He said, I didn't want to, but I didn't have a choice. Some of our clients in Abu Dhabi are starting to demand that we are vaccinated, and I cannot afford to wait for my turn for the Pfizer one, which is interesting. So the vast majority of people who are doing it are doing it because they want to, for whatever reason, but you are hearing more and more stories about people feeling that it's something that they should do for their professional lives, and I get that.
Look, there are many, many different reasons that people vaccinate, because it is quite a personal thing. I mean, you were just trying to get over the border into Abu Dhabi to get your knee done. That was your reasoning.
I just wanted a star on my Al Hosn app. Didn't really work out, but it's fine. But you're right. It was a very narrow, self-interested motive got me to take the vaccine in the first place, but I'm very glad I did. Yeah, we all have our own little stories in our heads, don't we, about why we're doing it. Broadly speaking, it's the same. We want to be protected against COVID-19, but we've all got a little backstory or subplot, haven't we, in our minds?
Oh, yeah. I mean, mine was, again, speaking of self-interest, it was I'm just over every time I see someone thinking, are you going to call me in 2 days or am I going to call you in 2 days? Because the sort of the low-level hum of anxiety from that is disturbing, and I just didn't want to be the one to, you know, and it's not, and I say it didn't want to be the one because there's no blame with this, is there? It's not a case of who's brought it into an office, because that is not a particularly effective or indeed realistic way of looking. You don't necessarily know who's had it first, but I just thought, you know, need to keep the show on the air. I don't like the fact that every time I meet someone for lunch or meet someone for coffee, I'm kind of weighing up the opportunity cost. So that was my thinking behind it.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk aviation now and get some more detail on one of our top stories. Emirates suspending flights to three cities in Australia this month, Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, due to, quote, operational reasons. The last flights to Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane are going to take off on Wednesday. Joining us on the line now to give us some perspective on this is the aviation expert and lawyer Nick Humphrey, a partner at Kennedy's here in Dubai. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Richard.
So what was your reaction as an aviation lawyer and also as an Australian when you saw this news?
Well, it's not surprising. Just last week, the Australian government has cut its flight caps, which it applies, by half. So now within the whole of Australia, no more than 5,000 people are able to enter 8 different ports. And Emirates, if you consider the capacity of their aircraft, which are all wide-body, mostly the 777s are flying to Australia, they were limited to 30 to 50 people before the cap per aircraft. So it makes commercial sense. The fact that they haven't given more than just saying operational reasons creates mystery, but it directly coincides with what's happening within Australia.
Flights are still going on to Perth, though, aren't they, which I know you have family ties to. Why do you think there's a different approach to the West Coast and the East Coast of Australia for these Emirates flights, Nick? Any thoughts on that?
Well, if you consider it just even as a matter of competition, Etihad ceased to service Perth, whether it was sometime last year or the year before. So it doesn't, I guess, from traffic coming through the UAE, you still have other international airlines flying into Australia, including Etihad and Qatar Airways. And they're sort of making a big deal about the fact that they're continuing to do so. So I think Perth is all about competition and also reverse cargo.
Give us a bit of background on this. Just how important are these routes for Emirates? Brandy and I were chatting a little bit earlier on. Of course, she's a Kiwi, a New Zealander, has done those routes many, many times. And she was saying that actually, you know, forget our personal relationship with this route, that those routes into Australasia, if we can look a bit more broadly, have been really, really important for Emirates commercially over the past 10 to 20 years. And that surprised me. I would have thought, okay, probably, you know, the India would have been a more important corridor. But give us some context on just how important those routes are, Nick, please.
Well, I guess Australia broadly as a market has been incredibly important. If you just have a look at take the fact that Emirates was a key sponsor for the Melbourne Cup for a number of years. It sponsors local sports teams. It owns a resort in the Blue Mountains. Its partner, Donata, is a significant investor in Australia. The Australian market is very important for Emirates and will continue to be so.
So is it fair to say that Australia in general, and Australasia more broadly, punches above its weight? Because I look at the population of Australia, Nick, and I see 25 million people, which is a very, very small market. You look at India on our doorstep, which is 1.3 billion people. And yet, in some ways, commercially, Australia, it seems, is not as important as India, but it is a significant market for Emirates, which just seems odd given the small size of the population.
Well, I don't want to describe us as odd people, but we have a yearning. Excuse me, we have a yearning to travel, and also on the other side, one of the major economic factors for Australia is overseas tourism, which is obviously being significantly affected. Australia does punch above its weight, but you know, it's not uncommon you jump on various international flights, and I'll hear my accent throughout the aircraft. I can't explain it. I think it's the Antipodean yearn to travel.
Let's talk about sport if we can. As we speak in Brisbane, one of the cities where Emirates is cutting its flights, we've got a major international sporting fixture taking place. It's Australia versus India in the cricket, the test match at the moment. But of course, in just a few days stroke weeks time, we've got a very significant international sporting event, the Australian Open Tennis Tournament. And lots of questions being asked about that now and how people are going to get there safely. What do we know about the role of sport in all of this, Nick?
Well, the Australian Tennis Open in particular is causing, let's say, some internal political murmurs, given that certain hard caps on travel have been placed, notwithstanding that more than 1,200 players and coaches and entourage have been allowed into Victoria. Now, one of the problems has been is that there have been a couple of positive tests, COVID tests amongst some of those who have flown in, and the players who are otherwise going to be allowed to, whilst being in quarantine, go and practice. I think there's about 50 players are now in hard quarantine for 2 weeks. So that's going to cause some challenges. With the cricket in Australia, I guess the benefit has been that the Indian team has been travelling in Australia for some time. They have been on some pretty strict quarantine restrictions, which almost compromised the Brisbane test. But it is interesting to see how sport almost elevates itself above, let's say, repatriating nationals and citizens, 40,000 of which are still overseas.
It's interesting. I saw the Indian cricket team were outraged when they got to Brisbane because of the measures in the hotel. They had to make their own beds. There's no service in the rooms at the moment.
There would be outrage in my household as well, Richard.
I think so too. But to go back to Emirates and the UAE, we have a significant role to play in the Australian Open Tennis Tournament, which is due to start on the 8th of February. It has been pushed back a little bit because the qualifying is happening here in the UAE and also in Doha, isn't it? So we've got to get a lot of people from here out to Australia.
Yeah, so one of the flights that someone tested positive was an Etihad flight. So Etihad continues to fly into Australia. So it seems to have covered, let's say, some of the capacity and the needs to serve and to deliver these players into Australia in time for quarantine and the beginning of the tournament next month.
A final quick question about an interview that Brandy picked up on over the weekend with Sir Tim Clark of Emirates, not to do with the Australian cities, but more broadly, what's happening with Emirates at the moment. And it was pretty upbeat, to be honest, from Sir Tim. He was talking about returning to profitability, not in the forthcoming financial year, but in the year after that. He was talking about the fact that they no longer need any financial support from the government because we've got things like Emirates Sky Cargo bringing in the revenue. It surprised us that he was so upbeat. Do you think his relative positivity is justified, Nick? Did you see that interview?
I continue to be a pessimist. And I think if anything is to go by, you know, the UK closing its borders, the greatest risk of aviation, and I've said this a few times that I've been on, is just uncertainty of government policies. And I think Sir Tim's comments, it's great that he sees a positive view, and I think a lot is pinned on the vaccine, but I think it may well be somewhat overly optimistic.
Nick, great talking to you as ever. Appreciate you getting up early to speak with us. That's the voice of Nick Humphrey. He's an aviation expert and a partner at the law firm Kennedy's, talking about the fact that from this week, Emirates is going to suspend its flights to three Australian cities, Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. Brandy, what do you make of Nick's comments?
It's interesting what he said there about the caps getting tighter. I was saying to someone this weekend, I was trying to explain how the caps worked and what they actually meant for airlines. And I didn't have the exact numbers. But yeah, 5,000 people into the entire country in 8 ports. And I'm guessing that's probably split between who's still flying? Singapore still flying? I'm guessing maybe Cathay. It was Emirates.
Qantas
and
certainly
Etihad.
Is not, is it?
No. Qantas won't be bringing back international flights really until the middle of the year. They've started taking bookings for the US and the UK from July. Hong Kong, I want to say Singapore, just 2 or 3 Japan, Asian destinations that they've been taking them for a little bit earlier, but none of those planes are actually taking off yet. It's a tricky decision for the airlines to make, but from where I'm standing, and I've thought the whole way through, you're not a charity, you're a business.
And Emirates is not there. It's not a wing of the Australian government, is it?
Literally, no, Richard. Well done.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
And then you can go to Expo this week if you want to. That's, you're hearing me properly, that's not a mistake. One Expo Pavilion will open up, the Sustainability Pavilion, the Terra Pavilion, on the 22nd of January, to give us all a little bit of a taste of what is coming up. Ahmed Al-Khatib is the Chief Development and Delivery Officer at Expo 2020 Dubai, and our producer, Mohammed Suleiman, went down to the Expo site yesterday for the launch of that Terra Pavilion. But like a good business breakfast presenter and producer, Mohammed began by talking about strategy and numbers. The Expo team are still expecting to attract 25 million people when that postponed event gets underway later this year. And Mohammed asked Ahmed how their strategy has changed because of the postponement.
As far as the major construction was already there when the pandemic hit. However, there were some minor constructions across the site that started to feel the impact of the pandemic around May time. And this is when the BIE and the countries, they voted to postpone the event by 1 year to October 1st, 2021. This is when we started relooking at our strategy on how we can spread the construction across the site. And then we realized actually by spreading the construction, it might cost us more. So we continued on delivering with the same timelines. We took all the precautions to ensure everybody working on Expo is safe and healthy. Since day one, we have a full clinic on our site. We built our own testing facilities for our workers. We tested all of our workers. We continue to monitor their health and safety. And we established the protocols across the site to deal with the pandemic, same as everywhere else.
Ahmed says that they are confident that all the participating countries in Expo will have their pavilions completed by this summer.
Since then, we continue to work closely with the countries to get their pavilions to completion stages. There's a lot of countries that have announced completion. For example, Saudi Arabia, they completed their building and their exhibitions. Finland, Norway, and so on. Egypt, USA. A lot of the countries have reached actually a completion stage. And as far as the exhibitions, we will continue working with them. And inshallah, towards like end of July this year, we are expecting all countries to be done.
Despite lockdowns intensifying in several countries, including big feeder markets into the UAE, thinking obviously about the UK there, Ahmed says they still expect those 25 million visitors when everything gets underway from October.
We haven't changed our commitment to as far as the number of visitors for Expo. And of course, like with the positive news we're hearing about the vaccinations and how it became part of our life, how to deal with the and to take all the precautionary measures like to deal with the pandemic. I personally believe it's not going to have a major impact. There will be a lot of visitors from across the world, inshallah, with all the positive news coming on dealing with this. And from now until October, we have about like 8 months left, which there's a lot, inshallah, can be happening between now and October in terms of fighting this pandemic.
But as I said, we are getting a little bit underway earlier than October. From January the 22nd next week, visitors in Dubai will be able to tour Expo 2020 Sustainability Pavilion. I say visitors, also obviously residents, citizens. Ahmed says it's important that the public is allowed to experience what Expo has to offer before it officially opens its doors to the world.
This is the best reward, to see everybody happy and enjoying this after this challenging journey in building this building. Of course, this is just a small teaser to the bigger opening of Expo 2020, and we wanted to make sure that the community of UAE, who has been actually our partner since day one after winning the Expo and going through the journey, to get a taste of this amazing opening and understanding of how the bigger Expo would be.
Ahmed Al-Khatib, Chief Development and Delivery Officer from Expo 2020 Dubai, speaking to our producer, Mohammed Suleiman.
So just on the back of that conversation we've been having about Australians looking to get back into Australia, this follows from the decision from Emirates to stop flights in the coming days into several ports, all bar one port in Australia. 37,000 overseas Australians now registered with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade as wanting to return to Australia at present. So we've just been going through some of the morning papers over in Australia and looking at how they're crunching the numbers. And there's one that's come through from Traveller magazine in Australia. Traveller have done their On a Wing and a Fare, the cost of getting home analysis at the moment. So pre-COVID, so 2019, this is based on a London to Sydney a flight at the moment. Okay, pre-COVID, 2019, $807 Aussie dollars to get London to Sydney on economy. Now, as it stands this morning, cheapest economy flight, cheapest London to Sydney is $6,258. It's going to take you 52 hours.
Say that again.
$6,258.
Economy.
Economy. It's going to take you 52 hours. KLM and Virgin Atlantic via Amsterdam, San Francisco and Los Angeles. So you've got to go the long way around.
And each of those airports are going to be a joy, I could imagine, right now.
Yeah. Cheapest business, not that far above that, $7,459. You'd probably just go to the business, wouldn't you? But it takes you an extra hour on business because you've got to go Finnair and Qantas via New York and Los Angeles. Cheapest first class ain't getting you there as of the end of this week because that's on Emirates. 53 hours. It's costing you $9,363. Emirates and Qantas via Dubai and Melbourne. The fastest economy for you is going to cost you, this is economy, $7,163. That's a 48-hour flight, Qatar and Spirit Airlines via Los Angeles. And the most expensive first class, if you're just going to do the whole lot, still going to take you 53 hours, it's going to cost you $36,895 BA and Qantas via New York and Los Angeles. So it just gives you an idea, not just of the price being incurred, but the logistics you've got to put into place as well. So, yeah, that gives you an idea of the numbers.
The Qantas thing is interesting
Because my working assumption is that Qantas has grounded pretty much all of its fleet at the moment. Does that mean that Qantas is flying, do we know? Or is it just a code share?
I think it's the code share thing, okay, isn't it? Yeah, that they work with other airlines on this code share. So if that airline is flying, gives them options too.
And as you said, we've got those 37,000 Australians registered as wanting to come home. And 24 minutes ago, the Australian federal government saying that they would be chartering those 20 flights in order to get them there.
I love this. So they made an example of one, Rebecca Giles, who's stranded in London, wants to get home. This is her story. She bought a business class ticket through Singapore Airlines back in November to fly on January 4th this year for $7,534 US dollars. Then, of course, Singapore put the brakes on planes from the UK because of the transmission of disease. So she had to cancel that ticket and couldn't find any economy tickets for any date, any month out of the UK to Australia. So the only ticket that she could find was Emirates first class ticket for $9,160 Aussie dollars one way to Perth. Ooh. For that amount. Obviously, that's all changed now as well. So we're waiting to see what happens moving forward. Obviously, that Perth flight will remain open, we're told, by Emirates. So that one is currently still valid for February the 4th. But again, it just gives you the idea. And just reading through this article, the one word that seems to sort of ring true is chaotic. The uncertainty that you were talking about at the moment is that you make these bookings, but you're not quite sure whether you're actually going to see those bookings through. So it is basically checking your options on a daily basis.
Well, maybe is this the argument for travel agents again? You know, we've all sort of wondered if the day the travel agent was over, why do you need someone else to book your flights for you? My father is convinced that Barbara at his local travel agent can see flights that he cannot see on the internet. Is this job security for Barbara?
Yeah, I suppose it's right. It's the time of the broker, isn't it? It's like, you know, what's the point of owning a stockbroker? Well, somebody who just keeps an eye on the figures for you and covers your costs, covers your indemnities. Same sort of, you know, keeping an eye on those fares, take the best advantage.
Yeah, go Barbara.
I've got an Adele. We're going on holiday for the wife's birthday next month.
You
week.
Think?
Yeah, exactly. Book through an agent.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we are going to have a look in Inauguration Week at two of the big global economies, two bits of news coming out of the weekend. One is US President-elect Joe Biden's plans for the American economy, big stimulus plan announced on Friday night, and a potential double-dip recession for the UK. We are very pleased to be joined now by Daniel Richards, senior economist at Emirates NBD. Morning, Daniel.
Hi, good morning, buddy.
Let's start with the US, Daniel, and Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus plan. How does that break down?
So it's a number of things. I think the key one really is it's going to be another $1,400 of direct helicopter money payments to households. That's on top of a $600 that was recently approved, and that was a figure that was actually sought by the incumbent Donald Trump previously and by the Democratic Party previously. So that's the key one. There are a number of other measures, including support for state and local government and some extra funding as well for specifically for healthcare needs for combating the pandemic crisis.
This is the third stimulus plan. Is it enough or is the money going to the right place?
I mean, it's quite a big amount, but the prospect of it all getting passed is pretty slim. The Democratic Party holds the Senate by a knife edge, really, and even some of the more moderate, you might say, members of that party have pushed back against the kind of figures being bandied about. So it's certainly needed. I think the data we saw at the end of last week from the US showed the necessity for greater spending, poor retail sales data, poor jobs data. But it'll really take all of Biden's many years of experience in cross-party discussions to get anything even close to this nearly $2 trillion passed.
What does that mean then for the US economy, and therefore what does that mean for the rest of us?
Well, it would certainly be a boost. There are questions about whether this would lead to greater jobs picking up and then push through into inflation and then potentially the Federal Reserve cutting back on quantitative easing and hiking rates faster than expected. We don't really hold to that view. We don't think that the Fed will hike anytime soon, and that was really poured water on by Jerome Powell at the end of last week as well. So the likelihood is, we believe, is that the dollar will remain relatively weak. And of course, that feeds through to us here, given our currency peg, and also that rates will remain low through 2021, 2022. And again, that feeds through to us here.
So good for the Dubai property market then?
Yes, I mean, essentially, we think that a weaker dollar will be good for Dubai competitiveness, help boost the economy that way. Lower rates should also help stimulate the economy. So all in all, we believe that this is generally, we do believe there's quite a positive outlook for UAE growth this year.
Okay, let's look towards the UK then, where we have had GDP numbers coming out for November. Falling again, what does the latest lockdown mean for the UK economy?
Well, as you mentioned, double-dip recession, I think it will be very hard to avoid. The figures we saw was a 2.6% month-on-month in November. That's when we had the number two, I believe it was, national lockdown. Obviously, that's a lot less than what we saw, the 18.7% contraction month-on-month back in April when it first began, suggesting that the economy is getting better at dealing with these lockdowns. But nevertheless, the first quarter will be very weak, given that these latest lockdowns are even more stringent than those seen in November and will likely continue past the February half term. It's looking more and more likely to some degree.
What's the economic impact of the UK shutting all of its travel corridors?
Well, I believe that is something we will feel here. The UK has been, over July to November, the UK was the fifth biggest source market for visitors to the UAE. And then in November, we had this brief period where there was a travel corridor. And I think everybody who's been out and about has really noticed the high number of Brits coming over here. Now that's been cut, I think it will lead to, you know, a bit of a dip in demand for UAE hotels here. Britons had, of course, previously been told they shouldn't travel anyway, but while they could return without quarantining, some may have chanced their luck in any case. But now they'll have to quarantine on return. I think it's very unlikely now they'll be coming. And given, you know, Dubai tourism, some 12% of the economy here, that will be another downside risk to growth.
But presumably tourism's been decimated into the UK as well.
Yes, of course. Yes, so no one's really travelling to the UK. Given the high rise in cases you've been seeing there, I mean, it started to dip again recently, but a high rise you've been seeing there, that has been ultimately decimated as well. And given the services sector accounts for some 80% of the UK economy, a large part of that, around 7-8%, is financial services, but tourism, hospitality as well, is very important. And if people, you know, it's not only people visiting the UK, it's also people resident in the UK aren't able to go out and spend either. So all in all, I think the outlook for the first quarter, at least probably the first half in the UK, remains very weak. And we're really hoping for a bounce back in the second half as these vaccinations start to take hold.
And that is, I mean, that word bounce back is one that I've seen in quite a bit of analysis this weekend. A vaccine-driven bounce back is the phrase that is being used. How likely is that? And I mean, you or I are not science experts, but we're seeing criticism of the rollouts of vaccine across Europe, across the US. We're now seeing concerns about whether some of the vaccines will reach people in time, whether that second dose will come in time. Is the hope for this vaccine-driven bounce back for Q3 and 4 for the second half of the year, are we just being a little bit too optimistic there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the past year has taught us, if anything, is to not be overly optimistic with the progress of combating this pandemic. And we've seen expectations pushed back as the cases surge again and new lockdowns have been imposed. So I would be a little cautious. And even, I think, if large numbers of the population have then been vaccinated, this idea will have a new roaring 20s as people go out and spend again. I'm a little wary of that view. I think people will remain quite cautious. And, you know, lots of people have higher savings rates over the past year. But equally, lots of people lost their jobs. And people would be more cautious, I believe, for a good period yet. So I do expect things will improve dramatically in the second half. But whether it will be quite to the degree that some people are speculating, I'm unconvinced.
And Daniel Richards, Senior Economist at Emirates NBD, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Douglas Emhoff.
I'm sorry?
Who's Douglas Emhoff?
I don't know.
Douglas Emhoff is a name we've got to get used to. I didn't know him until yesterday. He is the husband of the US Vice President-elect, Kamala Harris. And the reason that he's in the news at the moment is that he's just been given or granted a new Twitter handle. And it's quite funny. At Second Gentleman is his handle. which is a little play on the First Lady that's been going on for a while. Obviously, the first time it's ever been handed out. And Twitter handing the account to the new Second Gentleman who takes over that post on Wednesday of this week. Is that right?
Yeah, it will be. Do you know what? I do know, now that you say the name, he's also had a little bit of trolling on ye olde Twitter, because his he gets to put in his own little description, doesn't he, of who he is and what he's about. And his description is really quite nice. He basically talks about how he's the proud husband of Kamala Harris, yep. You know, happy to be the second gentleman, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite funny. It's quite tongue-in-cheek. But it is extremely flattering of her. And there has been quite a lot of trolling by various bros, shall we say, about how macho it is or isn't to describe yourself in relation to your wife's job.
Yeah, so she's becoming at VP, apparently. Obviously, Biden gets at POTUS.
There was a bit of a hoo-ha about whether he got to... Well, whether you get to inherit your predecessor's followers or if you reset to zero, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Would you want his followers?
Not sure his message is going to ring true with many of them.
Yeah, different demographic, I think.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.